The head of CAL FIRE says the state should consider rethinking some home construction in certain areas. We'll hear Director Chief Ken Pimlott's thoughts on that and much more as he prepares to hang up his hat tomorrow after 3 decades with the agency. Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler joins us for Cap Chat. He'll give us his take on California Governor Jerry Brown's recent comments about the Republican and Democratic parties. The Ochagea Cherokee Women Singers will preview this weekend's All Nations Native Craft Fair in West Sacramento with some singing and drumming. And the music doesn't end there. We will hear from Hannah Marie and Seymour Love. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak this week. That's today on Insight. From CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak this week. The past 14 months in California has witnessed several of the state's most deadly, destructive, and massive wildfires in recorded history. Overseeing the efforts to contain these natural disasters was CAL FIRE Director Chief Ken Pimlott, who has spent the past 30-plus years of his career with the agency. Tomorrow, Friday, he'll say goodbye as he heads into retirement. Today, he joins us live in studio to reflect on his time with CAL FIRE and give us some, as the show's title might suggest, insight on the state's wildfire management. Chief Pimlott, welcome to Insight. Really great to have you here today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Was there any overriding factor that led you to choose this moment to retire?
No, it's always been my plan to work through and support Governor Brown through this his term in office, and I've reached that point in that tenure in my career. So it was always planned to retire at this time.
It just happened to fall after some of the most destructive fires in history.
It did, and it's obviously been a challenging number of years, and will continue to be. So, when is the right time? But certainly for me, from a personal perspective, this has always been the plan, and I'm ready.
So this past year or so has been, I don't have to tell you, incredibly intense for your agency. You've said firefighters are living climate change as they face larger and more destructive wildfires. How have you seen the threats to those fighting these fires change in your time with the agency?
So over the last 3 decades, its fires are larger. They're more intense. The weather patterns are changing in such that they're more conducive to these more extreme events. And that's just in rates of spread, the intensity, acreage burned. We're now multiple 100,000-acre fires are burning every year. That was the exception to the rule, several decades ago. And as you said, most destructive, most deadly, largest, all happened within the span of just a few months this year. Long fire season. It's really all year now. Firefighters are working throughout the year, and in many cases, they're deployed months and with little break. And those, again, more the exception to the rule, in previous decades, but it's really becoming the norm.
Fires that would have become a household name almost become an afterthought when the next fire breaks more records.
Just a few years ago, when we talk about the Rim Fire, 2013 near Yosemite, that was over 250,000 acres and threatened Yosemite, almost now paled by the next set of fires, the Valley and the Butte Fire that destroyed homes in Lake and Calaveras and Amador County, followed up again by the Sobranos in Monterey County, and then 2017 with the devastating fall fire siege in the North Bay. And could anyone think it could get worse than what happened in Santa Rosa and Napa counties and some of the other counties? And then this year, already just in the summer prior to what's just happened in Butte County, we had very devastating fires in Mendocino and Shasta County. And now, of course, this, the Paradise, Butte County, Magalia. Just every year we continue to see more devastation, more destructive fires. And there's no indication that this is going to change.
Did you think it would be a while before we topped the numbers seen with the Tubbs Fire in that complex?
I certainly hope so. But the reality of it is we've been watching these trends, seeing the change, and we know that this is the trend. This is where we're going to be having fire in California. So while we didn't want it to occur, none of us should be surprised based on the conditions that this is what's happening.
Last month, U.S. Secretary of the Interior Ryan Zinke said this about the causes of wildfire in California during an interview on Breitbart News.
We know the problem. It's been years neglect. And in many cases, it's been these radical environmentalists that want nature to take its course. We have dead and dying timber. We can manage it using best science best practices. But to let this devastation go on year after year after year is unacceptable. It's not going to happen.
First, we should point out, he said it's not time to finger point, and then he pointed. But to his suggestion, is that the main cause of our wildfire problems in California, radical environmentalists?
Well, he's correct in that it's not time to finger point. We have to be in this all together. And I think we're looking at this across the board. Are there efficiencies in our environmental review processes, both at the state and federal level? But there's a lot of work to be done across the landscape, in the forested landscape, in our hardening our communities. It's going to take all of us and continue to take everybody working together in all aspects of this.
So it's the root of these fires like we've never seen before is multi-pronged.
The root is multi-pronged, and the reality is we're coming off of 5 years of drought. Vegetation is critically, critically parched. Even with rainfall that we've had several winters, it hasn't changed the condition. Temperatures are changing. The weather patterns are changing. The climate is changing to where we're seeing different vegetation move into areas that historically weren't there. All of that's part of this changing landscape, and that's going to be real as we go forward. And so it's all of the factors that we need to engage in to respond to this.
The president has repeatedly criticized forest management. How big of a role do you think forest management plays? How big of a prong, I guess, since we said that before?
Forest management is key, but it's really, I call it sort of a three-legged stool. It's forest management, fire prevention, fuels treatment, prescribed fire. Absolutely need to increase the pace and scale. Need to be smart where we target that, where we use leverage our funding and work on that. But it's about other factors, too. It's fire prevention. It's education. It's land use planning. It's ensuring that we're looking at what we're learning from these devastating fires in the built environment. And how do we work on those aspects as well?
You've said if we don't learn from what happened in Paradise and then last year, of course, in the North Bay, then we're missing the real issue. Help us understand that. What should we not be missing?
So the first 6 to 12 hours of the campfire, firefighters were literally engaged in rescue. Firefighters, law enforcement, ordinary, regular civilians. We weren't engaging in the firefight. We were just literally pulling people out of harm's way. In many cases, people couldn't evacuate because of the timing, and so they were sheltered in place in areas. Obviously, many people died in that fire. So we have to look at all of the factors that occurred in the campfire and others and determine, can we learn things from this? We have very strict building codes in the urban interface in California. We've got to look to see, are there needs for improvement? We need to work together collectively between local government, the state, and identify, are there areas that, again, we're going to build in these areas, but can we do it smartly? Are there areas that we know are just not defendable because they're fire prone? They're in canyons that are intensifying winds that just make it impossible to protect. So how can we look at development patterns and how can we look at ways to better protect these communities?
The intense winds that we saw in Butte County, Napa, Sonoma counties, when those winds are pushing fire like they are, is there really anything your agency can do to stop those fires at that point? Or do you have to really wait on Mother Nature to change the environment?
And there are always factors we can look at when we're there and take targets of opportunity. But the reality is when you have 40, 50 mile an hour sustained winds pushing a fire, you have a fire spotting, putting embers out over a mile ahead of the fire. Paradise, there were over 100 spot fires developing within the community of Paradise even before the flaming front reached. There's very little you can do to suppress those fires or stop that. And again, you're focused on saving lives.
California Insurance Commissioner Dave Jones said yesterday if people choose to build in high-risk wildfire areas, they may not be able to insure those homes unless the state steps in.
We are steadily marching towards a future in California where private insurance may not be available in high-risk fire, flood, and coastal areas. That is the future we face. unless dramatic steps are taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and contemporaneously, there are some policy changes made to make sure insurance continues to be available.
Is your belief, Chief Pimlott, that we should put more thought into where we build? Are there specific areas you believe should be off limits for building or insuring, as we just heard?
Absolutely. And insurance is a key part, working with the insurance industry together to determine what are the incentives. We need to look at areas that, again, are very fire prone, that, again, we talked about canyons, areas that really magnify the wind, that don't have ingress and egress routes where we can't safely evacuate. But we need to do this together. And there may be local land use planning decisions that can be made that help, again, clustering development so they can be protected if a fire comes through. It's going to take a lot of effort and collaboration from the insurance industry, from local land use planning, the state, fire safe councils, all across the board working together to solve the challenge.
We saw what can happen in Paradise. Should Paradise be rebuilt?
Certainly looking at Paradise, if I lived in Paradise and lost everything, but that was my home, folks are going to want to go back. And the county's certainly going to want to look in the city about how to rebuild that. I think now, and the mayor's been very clear about this, as she said, hey, look, in the coming months, we're going to sit down and talk about what's the right way to do it. And I think that's where we're at. This is the time for the conversation to look at what are the things that we can learn from this and improve. And not just in Paradise, but there are hundreds of communities across California with legacy construction built decades ago that are at risk. And so we can learn from what happened in Paradise and other places and apply that to even existing communities to help harden existing infrastructure and communities.
We're speaking with CAL FIRE Director Chief Ken Pimlott regarding the 2018 fire season, which will be his last before he retires tomorrow. When Governor Schwarzenegger was in office, he said there's no longer a fire season, that it's just year-round. Would you agree with that?
Completely.
Uh-huh. It's changed that much compared to when you were volunteering back in the mid-80s?
Yes. In the early to mid-80s, I actually started as a reserve firefighter in Contra Costa County and then moved into my career with CDF at the time and ultimately CAL FIRE. And yes, we all of us were looking at fire season here in the West as a seasonal, you know, those peak summer months with the shoulder months in the spring and fall. We literally have had fire conditions at times in Humboldt County in the last few years in January, one of the wettest areas in the state. And we had a 300 or more acre fire. And so the conditions can happen at any time now in the state, and we have to be prepared year round.
You've said that we need strict building codes. How would those be enforced?
So obviously, right now, California has wildland urban interface building codes that were adopted just over 10 years ago. As new construction comes into play, those are being utilized. The challenge is we have over 750,000 habitable structures in the state responsibility area. Those are the 30-plus million acres that CAL FIRE protects. So we've got to be able to look at ensuring those existing structures, how can we help defend those? Defensible space. Are there upgrades that we can help provide incentives for to have roofs changed out where that hasn't been done? How can we look at other improvements around structures to do that? But it's going to take all of us. We're increasing our defensible space inspections. It's really that's about public contact. It starts with FireWise communities. It starts with fire-safe councils. It's really a grassroots local effort where this communication has to occur with everyone living in the wildland.
Defensible space, that is really key in many areas, is it not?
It is absolutely key. We bring the firefighters. We bring the emergency response. We bring grants to help with forest management, forest health. But the key is what the homeowner needs to do to take care of their own property. And it starts with that defensible space, ensuring that there's clearance around your home to minimize or at least reduce the impact when a fire comes through.
And how about inspections to make sure people are doing just that?
Absolutely. Right now, CAL FIRE is targeting 250,000 inspections annually across the state responsibility area. That's our goal. And we become very close to that every year. But obviously, we're not reaching and contacting everyone. But that's the important piece. And the first priority, it's not, we don't use the stick, we use the carrot. We want to work with people to get the work done. At the end of the day, we want compliance. And so much of this is about education and helping homeowners understand why it's important to do this and how they can get it done.
So you've been with CAL FIRE during some very historic times. Have you seen anything that surprised you, like really surprised you, like the maybe the fire tornado up in Redding or those sorts of things?
Literally took the words out of my mouth. That I think we've all seen fire whirls. We've seen, you know, erratic fire behavior. But that it was an EF3 tornado, a half mile wide, that was just appeared and brought fire and wind down on firefighters and homeowners, really in an unexpected manner, and really never seen anything occur like that on a fire.
Anything that hasn't made the news that surprised you?
No. I think the reality, though, is our firefighters, CAL FIRE, and all of our local and federal partners are working very hard, and I couldn't be more proud of all of them. And CAL FIRE firefighters are working, throughout the year now, again, as we've changed this paradigm. And again, our workforce was never set up to be a year-round response, and we're working very closely with the legislature and administration to find ways to better support that, because as I've talked about, climate change is being witnessed and experienced every day by firefighters.
Who will lead these hardworking firefighters as we head forward? Has there been a selection process?
So an announcement will come out tomorrow as I transition out. But I will tell you, I'm very confident in this organization. The men and women who are leading and working in CAL FIRE will be in good hands. And obviously, having experienced the job and been part of it as the leader of CAL FIRE for the last 8 years, I understand the complexity of the organization and the mission and working with all of our stakeholders and partners. And it's certainly not an easy job, but I certainly would not, step down if I didn't feel very confident with the men and women in this organization taking it forward.
What words of wisdom will you give him or her to be sure that the future leader of CAL FIRE will be as successful as possible?
It's partnerships. None of us do this alone. And what I've learned, first and foremost, it's everyone that we work with, whether it's federal, state, local governments, our partners in public safety, our partners out in the counties, and folks in the environmental community. What we do is a very broad mission, and it's really engaging with all of the partners to get the work done.
We've talked a lot about how dire it is, really, with the changing climate and the different obstacles we face in keeping wildfires under control in California. What are you most hopeful about? What do you see as we move forward as being a bright spot?
Not ever in my 30 plus year career have I seen the level of commitment and engagement and unified approach to this problem. And it's those engaging in the forest health and forest management sector. I mean, we've got a forest management task force now. We've got just everyone coming together. And again, as I said, these partners at the state, local, federal level and non-governmental organizations all working together and really aligned in the same mission. I think California is leading the way in that. And so that gives me great hope. We just have to keep momentum going as we go forward.
Do you think our divided political times could be a stumbling block in achieving that?
I don't. Politics have no place here. And I think we've all said that very clearly that when public safety and disasters know no political party. And I have witnessed in my tenure as the chief how, particularly here in California, that gets set aside to get to the table. Yes, we have disagreements and we have different perspectives on things, but I have seen and witnessed all sides of the aisle rolling up their sleeves to tackle this problem, and I'm very heartened by that.
So after tomorrow, it's your private life. You can share what you like, but what happens after tomorrow?
Just going to, take some time, and maybe this sounds a bit cliche, but yes, take some time for family, take a break. I'll really need to reset and decide what's in it, for the future. I have not made any decisions, but I'm looking forward to reconnecting and just enjoying some other time.
Well, I know I say this from all of us at Capital Public Radio and the team here at Insight. Thank you so much for your 30 years of service with CAL FIRE and helping keep all of us safe during this time. Director of CAL FIRE, Chief Ken Pimlott, with us on Insight today. Thank you for spending your second to last day here on Insight.
Thank you.
And there is always more at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station. Cap Radio. You're listening to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ryak. When outgoing California Governor Jerry Brown spoke with Ari Shapiro for a final interview with All Things Considered, he had some stern warnings to share about climate change, income inequality, and what he identifies as the shortcomings of both the Democratic and Republican parties. Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler joins us now with this week's Cap Chat. Ben, as always, fun to talk with you here on Insight, or any time of day for that
matter. And you too, Randall.
Ben, I don't know if you got to catch that, but we spoke with outgoing Cal Fire Chief Ken Pimlott about his views on the causes of wildfire in California. And he believes that climate change certainly plays a role. It's no secret that climate change is a major issue for outgoing Governor Jerry Brown. He says it will take more massive wildfires and other environmental disasters, however, to get politicians to take meaningful action, but at a price.
I'm sure that the political leaders will respond after we have four or five more disastrous fires and four or five more floods and hurricanes and tornadoes and all that. The problem is the cost will be much higher and the political wreckage that much greater, because the burden of spending to recoup, to adapt, and to transition to a non-carbon world will be much higher, much harder, and will be wrenching to the democratic political system.
Yeah, the governor, as he sat in his breakfast nook at the governor's mansion, or as his team calls it, the executive residence. I think you can just call it a governor's mansion. Tuesday morning, I was there recording the interview for NPR, and his two dogs, Calusa Brown and Callie Brown, were jumping around, frolicking. And here the governor was talking about this parade of horribles, climate change and nuclear war and the issues with capitalism. And on this bright morning with his dogs frolicking around him, it was quite the contrast. The governor's warnings about climate change are not new, but what was interesting to hear him say in that clip was that he thinks political leaders will respond, but after more disasters.
He used the term political wreckage.
Yeah.
What is he referring to there? Just like people will lose their elected positions over this issue?
Well, that I think remains to be seen. I think you're going to see, I mean, look, if California's elected leaders were to do absolutely nothing about forest thinning or about trying to at least manage forests, as I think Chief Pimlott was talking about, to prevent future wildfires, there would be quite the case to make for voters that maybe they didn't deserve to be reelected. I think at this point, California lawmakers and Governor-elect Newsom have said there is a need to do more, and that they have done some in some of the bills that were approved in the last year. So we'll have to see what else happens. It certainly did, however, take a great number of catastrophic wildfires, historically devastating wildfires in California, to get to this point.
The governor also shared his thoughts on the nation's two main political parties.
Contempt for both of them, you might say.
Right, yeah.
Let's start with what he said, and then I will fill in the gaps. I think the clip that he's talking about is that we have is how he's discussing that, look, In earlier times, there were moderates in both parties who found ways to find common ground.
Between the two parties, there's a real sharp cleavage. It's a Grand Canyon of distance and gap, because Republicans talk different, think different, associate with different people, and for much of the country, live in very different places than Democrats. And the older brand of moderate Republicans and moderate Democrats forming a certain vital center, that's out the window.
And the governor, at a couple of later points in the interview, I was struck. I mean, I was not surprised by his disdain for the Republican Party, particularly in the age of Trump. I was, however, struck by some of his strong words about Democrats. And he's, you know, been a little pithy about Democrats in the past, and he's kind of portrayed them as a foil and used it that way to try to position himself as someone in the center of California's politics, which folks on the left and the right might disagree with. But the terms that he used were more strident than maybe I had heard him say publicly in the past. For example, he said the Republicans, their problem in California is they only know how to say no. Democrats only know how to say yes, even to harebrained schemes. And he also, you know, went on to say, look, I think there's, you know, the Democratic Party has gotten further out, he said, too far to the left is what he's referring to, than I think the majority of people want. So there's plenty of opportunity for Republicans if they just pause, look at the world as it really is, and try to come up with something in the tradition of Lincoln and Eisenhower and other great Republicans. His warning to Democrats, don't get overconfident because pride always comes before a fall. And his advice to Governor-elect Newsom, figure out the worst possible thing that could go wrong and plan like heck to make sure it doesn't happen.
That's good advice. The governor also shared, or I should say we're speaking with Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler about outgoing California Governor Jerry Brown's final interview with NPR before leaving office. And Ben, let's hear the governor's thoughts on capitalism as he told All Things Considered's Ari Shapiro.
Capitalism is not a perfect system. It's a very productive system, but no one said anything about equality or protecting the environment. Capitalism responds to incentives, to human desire, to restlessness, and even, to put it more bluntly, greed. And that drives it forward. But it drives forward in a way that always overshoots its mark. And that's why every few years, or every so often, in fact, 10 times since World War II, the country in California goes into recession. Sometimes very deep recession.
He's always warning about the recession to come.
He is. But this, I think, went a little further in his comments about capitalism. And he talked about with, you know, the housing prices skyrocketing and automation in the workforce. He said people are now, a lot of people are now what they call redundant, or put more harshly, surplus. I've never heard that phrase used about humans before, because the economy doesn't have a role for them. And so Brown says there's a need for creative political leaders to find a way to tame and restructure capitalism.
Ben, while you recorded this interview for Ari at NPR, you yourself will sit down with the governor in the days to come.
That's true. And we'll have that, the fruits of that interview probably after the holidays in the final days of Jerry Brown's time in office.
He's to me, it seems like he's positioning himself for something after the governorship. But is there anything left?
Well, you know, if you ask him, he'll say he's not running for president. He's ready to retire. But he'll also joke that maybe he'll run for Colusa County Supervisor. Of course, he has a ranch up there, which we plan on visiting in the coming weeks. So, you know, I think Jerry Brown always has another act. Whether it's in politics or not, I don't know. But he has joined the agency. It's the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, the agency that runs the doomsday clock. He is a United Nations ambassador for climate change, trying to get regional governments to do what some national governments will not. And Jerry Brown's not one to just permanently sit quietly at his ranch. But, you know, he is, you know, in his 80s, and he has served a more than 50-year political career. And maybe, just maybe, he, or more accurately, his wife and the dogs are ready to take it easy for a bit.
Right. Well, I really look forward to those conversations with Jerry Brown that you will be presenting in the weeks to come.
Yeah, thanks.
Cap Radio's Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler, thanks for being here for another episode of Cap Chat.
You're
we
welcome.
always have more at capradio.org/insight, right? You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio.
Thank you.
You are listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Reack this week. This Saturday, the Cherokees of Northern Central Valley will host the 8th annual All Nations Native Craft Fair in West Sacramento. Joining us today is Tonya Elliott, Dr. Shirley Rowland, Gwen Cochran, Valerie Ritalik, and Brandy Leonard of Ochagea, a Native American women's drum group which performs songs in Cherokee. They'll be performing at the craft fair, and they're here to talk about that as well as their music. And welcome all of you to Insight. It's terrific to have you here in studio.
Thank you.
How long have the members of Ochagea been performing together?
Wow, off and on, about 14 years.
About 14 years. Mm-hmm. And if I could just bring you into the microphones just a little bit closer so that we can hear you loud and clear. Mm-hmm. I appreciate that. How did the group get started?
It was started by a woman by the name of Barbara Warren, who is our former drum keeper. She's one of our elders, and she wasn't able to be here today, unfortunately. But so Gwen Cochran and Barbara Warren were two of the founding members of Ochagea. And Shirley's been around from the beginning as well. Okay, mm-hmm. And Shirley as well, yeah.
Wow, so what was it like back then when you came together? Was it, first of all, is it traditional for the music groups to be separated by gender?
No, it's not traditional that women sit at the drum for a lot of tribes. So we women, Ochagea, came together out of a hand drum group that we played hand drums. And one day we were sitting around and we said, well, we need to do a mother drum. And we kind of said, oh, this would be fun. And so that's kind of where we got our start. It was just coming from our hand drums into the mother drum, which is the large drum. And from there, Ochagea just kind of evolved into what we are today.
And from the beginning, Shirley, did you choose to sing in both Cherokee and English?
Absolutely. One of our purposes is to carry on the language. Our language is dying out due to the fact that us elders are dying out. And so there is language preservation programs throughout the Cherokee Nation and the Eastern Band Cherokee. And we women have also decided that this is one of the things that we wanted to do with our music is to carry on the Cherokee language.
Tonya, do you find that people are surprised that there are Cherokees in California? Because I think most people think of Cherokees in Oklahoma and in North Carolina and those regions.
Indeed. Well, due to Indian relocation, there are a lot of Native people in California that are from other places.
Right.
But yeah, so we're also affiliated with the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma. At least California Cherokees are the CNCV group. So we do get to go back and engage in cultural immersion experiences there. So,
would you call the music that you all perform traditional?
Not necessarily. It's not traditional.
I heard a whisper of a
no,
yes.
Gwen says
and then...
yes. the language, yes. No. Yes. The sitting at a drum, yes. But for women, not necessarily. So, and this is our way of bringing women together to not just learn the language, but also to have a way of interrelating, with our values system and teaching the next generation about our Cherokee values.
There are other Native American musical groups in Northern California doing similar work, of course. Do you collaborate with these other musicians?
Absolutely. Yes, we do.
Uh-huh. Tell us about that.
It's those women, April Goforth and her group.
I'm going to pull you into the mic just a little bit. They've been around for
a long time, and April Goforth is one of our mentors.
Oh, okay. And inspirational and
yes.
Adds to what we then hear and what we will now hear. If I can give you a moment to get into position and perform for us, what will we be hearing?
The first song we're going to sing is called Beautiful World. Osta Alenitoa means that this is a beautiful life and life is good. So that's the first song we're going to sing.
All right, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Will this be in both English and Cherokee?
Mostly in Cherokee.
Uh-huh. All right. One of the songs you'll be performing this weekend?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'll be quiet now. I hope that the people listening on the radio get the same sensation of the drum beat that washes over you as you sit here and listen. That's part of the whole process of the song, is it not?
Yes, indeed.
Yeah. Yes. And I'll need one of you to come back over to the microphone so that we can hear your responses. But this will be, well, let me first reintroduce everyone. Tonya Elliott, Dr. Shirley Rowland, Gwen Cochran, Valerie Ritalik, and Brandy Leonard is who you just heard there performing, all members of the group Ocha Gaya, and they'll be performing at the All Nations Native Craft Fair this weekend. And this will be the 8th annual fair, as I understand. For people who haven't been, what can they expect?
See lots of arts and crafts that are handmade.
Uh-huh.
Traditional arts and crafts.
And is there, does the fair have a rule that it must be handmade? Because, you know, sometimes you go to the different weekend craft fairs and stuff, and I wonder,
yes.
You know, how do I know this is authentic?
I don't know that it's necessarily a rule, but
yes, it is.
It is? Okay, Shirley says it is. But it, definitely there's a culture of the kind of people that we know and that we invite into these events that some of the art, the crafting is just exquisite. I mean, beautiful. And most of them will have a card that will have their tribal number on the back or something like that. But they're all handmade. Yeah.
I mentioned the beat of the drum creating a sensation. And Tonya, I know you are the official drum keeper.
I am.
Tell us a little bit about that role.
Well, I mentored under Barbara Warren for a number of years before I took on the role, which is traditional in anyone who carries a drum. So that was quite an experience. And then all of these women, so Ocha Gaya means we women in Cherokee, and all of the women who sit at our drum, would have to support that decision of who becomes the next drum keeper. And so we're a very tight-knit family. Oriented, just we call each other sisters, but my job is to actually take care of the drum itself and to play a leadership role. But we are pretty much self-governed in terms of how we relate with one another.
I always find it fun to share like behind the scenes moments that listeners don't always, have access to. And when we were setting up for the different musicians and such that were going to be here today, the drum could not stay here in the studio. You brought the drum back out with you.
I did.
And so it really is a close relationship with this drum you have. It can't really be out of your sight.
No.
That is correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So even though it's not as traditional for women to carry drums, I can't get into those reasons why we do, but we do now. But some of those traditions actually came from the men's drums as well. So they have similar types of protocol where, we believe that the drum has a spirit and that there's energy and medicine in that. And so as a drum keeper, it's my job to be responsible for that.
That's a big role.
It can be.
You don't take lightly.
No, I don't.
No. Are you involved in organizing the event this weekend, or you are right over here? Yes.
Yes. I'm a member of the Cherokee's Northern Central Valley, and we are the ones that host the All Native Craft Show every year. This year, we've had to find a new location, and we will be at 905 Drever Street in West Sacramento at the VFW due to reasons that we could not continue to meet in Roseville at the Maidu Center.
I see.
The council members are the ones that put this on, and I am a former council member and an advisory to the council today. And so I have been working closely with them to get this organized and set up. We will also have the California dancers there, the youth group. The dancers will be joining us also at the craft fair. It's not just a craft fair. We do opening ceremony. We have traditional cultural stuff that goes on throughout the day during the craft show. And yes, everything is handmade. We say we don't want anything from Japan. The crafts are all native craft. Everything from art. The West Sac Art Guild is joining us this year to be a part of our craft show. So we'll have some wonderful art as well as the handmade gifts.
And that's Dr. Shirley Rowland, one of the founders of Ocha Gaya, who we had the pleasure of listening to here. The rest of the group is Tonya Elliott, Gwen Cochran, Valerie Ritalik, and Brandy Leonard. Thank you so much for joining us here in the studio today. We really appreciate it. And we'll have more information about the craft fair, of course, on our website at capradio.org/insight. And you are listening to Insight here on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Ocha Gaya Docha Noginaku. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak, and we're going to keep the music going this hour here on Insight with two artists who explore their own artistic and cultural roots. Sacramento native, now Portland, Oregon resident, Hannah Mayrie is an artist who plays banjo, accordion, and sings. You may remember Hannah's music. We featured a cut from the folk album Thoughts of the Night during an episode of Insight Music last summer. Hannah, welcome back to Insight. Good to have you here.
Hello.
And Hannah is joined by Seymour Love, a multi-instrumentalist and artist, also from Portland. Great to have you here as well.
Hello.
Welcome to Insight to you both. All right. Tell us about the genesis behind the West Coast tour that you planned together, Hannah.
Yes. So I am from Sacramento and have been living in Southern Oregon recently. And our tour started up in the Pacific Northwest. We played shows all around the Salish Sea, which is the sea territory of the Coast Salish people. And we made our way down here, have played 7 shows, and we have 2 more, our last 2 being tonight. And Saturday, and we're going to be at St. Paul's Episcopal Church. Mm-hmm. Doors will be opening at 6:30, and the show will start at 7:30.
And one of the shows that you performed was yesterday in Chico. It was a Camp Wildfire benefit, right, Seymour?
Yes, that's correct.
And how did that turn out?
Oh, it was lovely. A lot of people came and showed support. We raised over $213 in money for the benefits of going to the victims of the fires. And we also took instrument donations for musicians who had lost instruments in the fire as well. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people in the community came and really showed love. And so it was really great.
You both have new albums in the works. Seymour, let's start with yours. Tell us about what you're working on.
My new album is called Free, and it's available on most major platforms online. I put it together with the idea of musical healing, with the intentions of musical healing. And so it starts at 40 hertz and works its way to 10,000 hertz, going through the chakra system. There are compositions using classical techniques from classical music, but blending hip-hop, jazz, and elements of just a free expression of my own.
Hannah, you joined us with Thoughts of the Night last year. There's a follow-up soon?
Absolutely.
And what will the focus of that one be?
This is very much an expansion of the first in terms of being rooted in the earth and rooted in our personal healing that goes back to the land and our ancestors and moving forward.
Mm-hmm. You're both sound checked and set up to play. Seymour, I understand you have a piece that you're going to play for us here. This is from your new album?
No, this is not from my new album. This is an idea of something that you'll get from the show, which is often improv, but I do some of the pieces that I've composed as well.
Okay, and what's it called?
Song number one.
Okay, song number one, here we go. Thank you. go. And a little hidden message there at the end. Seymour Love, music from not his new album, but something you might hear at the show tonight. Also in studio with us is Hannah Mayry. They're on their West Coast tour with a stop tonight at St. Paul Episcopal in Midtown Sacramento. And we just have a few seconds left. But Hannah, one of the things you've been teaching your audiences is the history of the banjo as a colonized instrument, and that you're reclaiming that music.
Yes, it's definitely something that's always belonged to us as people of the African diaspora, people who are here on this continent, and we're all doing so much healing right now. And that's what this is supportive of us.
Well, I want to really thank you both for being with us today and sharing your music here on Insight. And good luck with the show tonight as you wrap up the tour.
Thank you very much.
And that's Hannah Mayry and Seymour Love, their show tonight at St. Paul Episcopal in Midtown Sacramento, 7 p.m. That's Insight for today. I'm Randall White. Insight is produced by Jen Picard, Bert Johnson, and Cody Drabble. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Today's engineer was Anthony Van Hook. Our technical director is Mark Jones. Our theme music was composed by Joe Gilman and Paul Conley. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr. We're back with another live show tomorrow. As always, thanks for joining us.